"I'll get to Hyde Park Sunday a.m.," FDR told Daisy in September of 1938, just as the Munich Conference got underway in Europe. "And there must be a view of the cottage, and perhaps you'll come too. And perhaps all kinds of things. I'm getting a little incoherent. But so would you if you were I. It's a nice feeling and has lots of possibilities, just like the European situation at this moment. But all of your possibilities are nice ones."
Historian and biographer Jeffrey Ward. He'll be back in just a moment with more about Closest Companion, the story of the intimate friendship between President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his cousin Margaret Sukley. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. When Franklin D. Roosevelt died in the spring of 1945, the intimacy and depth of his friendship with his cousin, Daisy Sukley, were virtually unknown to the public. The story stayed that way until Margaret Sukley died in 1991. At that time, a cache of her letters came to light and fell into the hands of historian, film writer, and biographer Jeffrey Ward. His edition of Daisy Sukley's correspondence with FDR is entitled Closest Companion, the unknown story of the intimate friendship between Franklin Roosevelt and his sixth cousin. According to author Louis Auchincloss, FDR once told his cousin Margaret Sukley that she was the only person with whom he could be entirely himself. Auchincloss continues that it's astonishing and exhilarating in view of all that's been written about him that we should at this late date have a wholly new and even more sympathetic picture of this curiously lonely great man in his private moments. Jeffrey Ward, former editor of American Heritage magazine, is the author of two books about FDR's early life, Before the Trumpet and A First-Class Temperament. He's also co-author of the public TV series on the Civil War and baseball.
I think you begin with the facts. I wouldn't know. I never have written about anybody that I started with a theory about. I don't think applying a template to anybody. I don't think people live their lives by templates. And I think they always, you have to keep in mind that they always have various choices they could make. And you try to figure out why they made the one they did. But I think that's sort of, if there is a key, I think that's the key.
Sure. Before we come to FDR and Daisy and Closest Companion, give me a sense of what you went through, the challenges, the perils and rewards when you did your two books on the early career of FDR. How did that come together for you?
Well, it was a great joy to do. He's an absolutely fascinating, mysterious person who is both more and less, I think, than he appears, and I guess like everybody. And trying to untangle all that was a great pleasure to do. It started when somebody told me he'd made some recordings in the Oval Office that nobody knew about, and I listened to them, and I was just dazzled by that voice, and I wanted to figure out how anybody who sounded like that, both on and off the podium, got that way, and I spent 8 years trying to find out.
Did it intimidate you that here you're working with somebody of protean proportions and a man who clearly, deliberately wants to hide parts of his personality, not only from the public, but with the ego involved here? I mean, he must have had some sense that biographers were going to go to work on him sometime.
Oh, I think he had a very large sense that biographers were going to go to work on him, and he did try to hide things. But I think what I was trying to do was start with his very earliest days. And I think once you start doing that, you begin to see the kinds of things someone would hide, and then you try to uncover them. I certainly didn't uncover them all, but I got some of them.
Did you have an agenda when you were writing about the early FDR? That is to say, to reveal things that hadn't been revealed? We're back to the question of chronology and sequence and interpretation.
Well, I don't think anybody's biography or anybody's history works unless you do it chronologically. I'm very simple-minded about that. Things unfold in actual time, and rearranging it doesn't work. People live their lives that way. They deal with personal things and public things on the same day. Unless you understand that, you're writing about an abstraction.
Tell me about the relationship between FDR and Daisy. Pronounce the name now for me, so we get
Sukley.
Sukley,
like Bookley.
All right. Tell me about this relationship that is only recently, and in your work, come to light.
Well, let me just say, I did these two very large books about FDR, and I thought I knew all of his important private secrets. and I did not. I knew that he had a sixth cousin, a rather dowdy, quiet, soft-spoken sixth cousin named Margaret Sukley.
People gave her all sorts of put-down nicknames, didn't they? You know, this sort of person who was on the edges of his consciousness.
Yes. His staff, in fact, called her the little brown mud wren because she was so retiring. People thought she was part of the furniture. Well, it turns out she wasn't part of the furniture, and when she died in her 99th year, they found under her bed a suitcase, and in the suitcase were 38 longhand letters from FDR and thousands of pages of diaries. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that she really was closer to him than to anyone else, at least during the war years.
And to the question, did you keep a diary, and what do you know about FDR? Before you met her, as I understand it, she had always said, me, keep a diary?
What would make you think that I kept a diary? Uh-huh. As though it couldn't be a sillier idea. But she'd always smile, and she knew perfectly well that that was all under her bed, and that someday someone would find it.
Well, tell me about this friendship or this companionship. How would you characterize it in general terms, and then we'll look to some specifics?
Well, it was a very intimate friendship. It was not a love affair, at least not a physical relationship. I think they were in love with one another on some level, and the letters certainly bear that out. But she was a sort of selfless companion. She wanted nothing from him except to be near him, and he was a very lonely man. That's hard for people who see film of him. He seems so outgoing and ebullient. But in fact, he was trapped in his wheelchair for the last 24 years of his life, and his wife was very often away doing the things that made her Eleanor Roosevelt. And Daisy became a sort of surrogate companion for him.
It was important. How should we put this? The women in FDR's life were very important in shaping his personal and public persona, and his mother is certainly somebody that we don't want to overlook.
His mother is the heroine of my first books. She was in many ways, I think she was a dreadful mother-in-law, but she was a wonderful mother.
She loved him unconditionally.
Yeah. And in fact, if your definition of a mother is someone who makes their child think that they can do anything and succeed at anything, then she's the world's champion mother, because he certainly believed that.
Was there any particular, parallelism between the way she acted in his life and the way Daisy came to be a part of his life?
Yes. His mother died in 1941. And without her, she was in many ways overbearing, but he deeply loved her. And it's the only time anyone ever saw him cry was when he, after she had died. And Daisy became not really his mother exactly, but she filled the same sort of role of enormous admiration, great good humor. They were from the same very sheltered and isolated Hudson River world, and she loved the same gossip that his mother had loved and that his wife was bored by.
Just tell me parenthetically, Jeff Ward, what was that Hudson River culture like? What did they have in common? I mean, this is really a world that's removed from
it was
from our lives.
It's the world of Edith Wharton. It's a world of beautiful houses on the Hudson, on large estates with big staffs of servants, and really very English life. They saw themselves as sort of the American parallel to English country gentlemen.
Daisy talked about her father and said that he was, you couldn't tell him from an Englishman.
That's right.
And that was a high compliment.
Well, he listed himself on his passport as gentleman.
Right.
And that's the sort of people that Roosevelt came from and that Daisy came from. And while he, more than anybody else, probably changed that world, he also loved it. And she was a reminder of where he came from, I think.
When did they meet and how did they meet?
Well, they first met when she was 18 and he was 28, and she saw him, he was married then, but she saw him dancing with everyone at a New Year's party at one of the great houses on the river, and she never forgot it. She told me that, and her eyes just glittered at the memory 90 or 80 years later.
Right.
They didn't really become close friends until he became president, and he began to invite her down to see him at the White House, and it became a closer and closer friendship, really. And she was with him until the day he died. In fact, when he lapsed into unconsciousness, he was holding her hand.
She was the woman who heard the famous last words of
yes,
FDR.
I have a terrific pain in the back of my head.
Right. Now, before they became good friends, she was a professional companion to
an elderly aunt.
That's right. And then basically she moved into that role with FDR
that's
himself.
Correct.
And that was what, in the early 1930s?
Starting with 1941.
1941.
When she was with him all the time.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the time, she saw him on weekends and whenever he came up to Hyde Park.
And what did they do together?
They took long drives. They had picnics. He built a cottage, which, in fact, she had hoped to share with him, overlooking Mrs. Roosevelt's cottage.
No, wait. We know this for a fact, that at some point she planned to, be his sort of live-in companion?
Yes. You have to remember with FDR that he was an invalid.
Uh-huh.
Again, for all the ebullience in the public films, he couldn't dress himself, and he had a valet and so on for all of that. But, I don't think the fact that she hoped to share this cottage with him means anything sexual at all. It just means that she was going to be there to hear him cough in the night and get him an extra blanket and have breakfast with him and keep him cheerful.
Tell me, Jeff Ward, about their correspondence. Your book is Closest Companion. It is you are the editor, basically, of this series of documents that flowed between FDR and Daisy Sukley. What did they write about?
Well, he was remarkably candid with her. I think he saw in her someone he could confide in and who, unlike his mother even, and his wife certainly, wouldn't, if he complained, wouldn't sort of tell him that was unworthy of being a Roosevelt.
Uh-huh.
And so he complains to her about his braces that he has to wear to greet the crowds on a train trip.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells her how terribly tired he is of being president in 1935, which astonished me. He said, why run again? Why have this horrible job with the basket of mail waiting?
Was she therefore important to him politically in a way that we have been unaware of before you came across this correspondence?
I don't think she was important to him politically if you mean she influenced politics.
Right.
She didn't. In fact, I think part of her charm was that she didn't talk politics much with him.
Uh-huh.
But she gave him the kind of support he needed, I think, and she kept him company, and I think she kept him alive toward the end. The most poignant part of this book, really, are the last 150 pages or so, which deal with his illness.
Mm-hmm.
And she was his sort of daily nurse. She made sure he took his pills, ate his lunch, got his nap, didn't see somebody or didn't mm-hmm. see somebody, or the meeting ended soon enough.
Sure.
And I think the country owes her a debt, really, for keeping him alive at least several weeks longer than he might otherwise.
Well, now, let me argue with you for the sake of insight as well as argument, the other side of that case. Can we look back now in our age of political correctness and say that here was a woman who was a victim, that FDR was, in effect, taking advantage of the goodwill that existed in her heart toward him? How do you finally come down when you interpret her stance, her...
Mrs. Roosevelt once said that her husband had had no real confidants. Even she had not been his confidant, and that people served his purposes, which is a pretty cold thing to say.
Oh, that's very harsh.
It's mostly true, I think. And I think Daisy was one of those.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean he didn't have enormous affection for her. But I think, I also think she saw it as a sort of, as well as a personal mission, a patriotic duty. I mean, you do have the sense that she knows he's leading the world in World War II, and that everybody wants him to stay healthy and alive.
Is there any evidence that she thought of herself as a doormat?
No.
What was her self-esteem quotient like?
Well, I don't think it was enormous, although she was, when I knew her, I met her once when she was a very old lady, 94, and she was still extremely funny and very sharp.
Uh-huh.
And I think she was good company. I mean, she wasn't just a doormat. She was just quiet when other people were around, and she was observing them all because she knew in the end, when everybody else left, she'd still be there. And what she wanted out of life for a while was to be with him. I mean, I think she really did love him.
Uh-huh.
And, I guess you could make her a victim, or you could see her as a very selfless and devoted person.
Tell me the story, Jeff Ward, about the suitcase under the bed and the way these letters and this correspondence came to light after Daisy's death.
Well, I should say, for somebody who spent 8 years working on FDR and who, as I said, did think they'd somehow got it all, or at least got most of it, to have somebody call up and say, guess what we found, and won't you come and see if there's possibly a book in it, and then to look at that pile of stuff, I tell you, it was a thrill. It was just wonderful.
And what was there? Quickly give me a sense of
well,
that.
Well, it was just pages. There were little diaries, various sizes, that she'd kept. She had one a year for each of those years, and various envelopes of letters, including one envelope which simply had bits of FDR's letters. It would have a disconnected paragraphs cut out of letters. We don't know what was in the other letters, of course.
So she did some editing herself here.
She did. And there was a great question. I had a great question, which was that if she hadn't given these to anybody, did she want them published? But I finally decided that FDR had given her a job as an archivist at his library. So
that
she had spent 30-odd years around papers and people who did books. If she really had not wanted these things ever found, I think she would have burned them.
So there is something there.
So somewhere she wanted it known what her role had been in his life, I think, on some level. And I'm very happy to have been able to do that. And the proceeds from the book, by the way, most of them, go to save the house that she lived in, which is an absolutely marvelous house up on the Hudson, which anyone should go see. It's called Wilderstein. It's in the town of Rhinebeck.
Tell me the story, Jeff Ward, about the famous, well, maybe not famous, but the important drive that FDR and Daisy took in, what was it, the mid-1930s, and they went up to a place called Our Hill.
Yes.
Tell me about that, and then speculate on the importance of that.
Well, I know the date. On September 22nd, 1935, they took a drive to a hill which overlooked the Hudson, and overlooked a lot of the Roosevelt property. And there something happened between them, which was the start of what FDR called this voyage. I don't know what happened. They may have kissed, and there is a poem, very uncharacteristically, a poem called Eros, which is pasted into her diary at exactly that point. And from there, and then he invited her, I think at least, that they talked about sharing secrets with one another, that they were very deeply involved with one another.
They had nicknames. They had nicknames for
one another. Oh yes, they coined nicknames for one another.
A certain person, right.
They were called, right? And they signed their letters, or addressed their letters, M.F. for my Franklin and M.M. for my Margaret, and so on. They sent each other, or tried to, messages through space. They would each agree to send a message at a certain time. And
now, wait, you're telling me that the President of the United States was experimenting with telepathy.
Yes, he was.
All right.
Yes, he was.
Well, that's an interesting platform for another line of questioning, Jeff Ward, namely, how much we know and how we know it about our prominent politicians. I mean, you know, here you are reciting these apparently minor, trivial facts and figures about this relationship between President Roosevelt and his sixth cousin. Today, in the 1990s, man, that would be all over the newspapers everywhere.
Sure.
For one thing, how did it stay out of the papers then?
I think the press was very different then. I think I once did a list, I'm not sure I can remember all of it now, but if in 1933 you had known some things about FDR that we now know, whether in today's climate he could ever have been elected, beginning with his health, which was that he was, a paraplegic. Unable to stand unaided. Most Americans didn't know that.
There were two pictures of him, two or three pictures that were taken.
Two of him in a wheelchair, and she took both of them, which is the, and they were not published in his lifetime. And I think that's the most vivid sense of how much he trusted her, because that's all there are in the world. Photographers would not take pictures of that. They were instructed not to, and they did not. The Secret Service very gently confiscated film from tourists who didn't know those rules and took a picture, and then they would return all of your film to you except the pieces that had pictures of him looking helpless.
One harsh word for that is censorship. And it would be a healthy thing that in the 1990s the press does what it does as best as it can. Back then, on the other hand, we can look and we say, wait a minute, you know, those are strong arm tactics. How did we get from there to here?
Well, that's a big question. But it was very different then. I mean, the country, I think, wanted him to succeed, and the press was part of the country. And so they didn't see any reason. And in any case, his illness did not, in fact, affect his being president at all, except toward the end. And that was another illness. That was his heart. Anyway, that's one of the things that if people... Then he did have a relationship which was fairly well known with Lucy Mercer during World War One.
Mm-hmm.
There had been, when he was at the Navy Department, a scandal having to do with homosexuals in the Navy. I mean, there are lots of these issues keep coming back.
Right.
And he had had, like a lot of other prominent Americans, made some very foolish investments in the 20s and had allowed his name to be used rather loosely in some stock schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, all of those would have been grist for, you know, Whitewater headlines and so on.
Do you think that really we live in a healthier, a better, a more productive...
I don't think it is healthier.
...national culture when we speak of how intrusive the press is today as set against the days of FDR?
I think we're very confused about what's important now. And I think there's what Arthur Schlesinger has called an industry of cynicism, mm-hmm. in the country, in which you don't believe what anybody says and you assume the worst of everything.
Uh-huh.
Every motive is suspect, and I would not want to be in politics today.
Now, does that make of you, Jeff Ward, some sort of neoconservative or traditionalist? I mean, the fallout when somebody puts a question to you like that is, oh, this is a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
How do you characterize it, if it's not partisan and political?
I suppose I want to quickly say I'm not a neoconservative. I think I'm a New Deal liberal, if there is such a thing anymore.
Right.
No, I just find it very unfortunate that we are so obsessed with trivial private life stuff,
uh-huh.
and we don't focus on issues and problems.
Well, let's step back from that issue, and let me ask you, Jeff Ward, to talk about the way Americans get their history. You are not only the author and editor of Closest Companion, this book about Daisy Suckley and FDR, you have also written a two-volume biography of FDR's early years. You have written The Civil War on television, baseball. My goodness, you live in two worlds, don't you? High scholarship and mass culture. Is that a continuity or a tension?
I hope it's a continuity. For better or worse, most people get what little tiny bit of historical knowledge that we have these days from television.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you can just reach... 40 million people watched baseball,
mm-hmm.
and 38 million, I think those are the numbers, 38 million watched Civil War.
Okay, so let's not criticize the medium. Let me ask you about the responsibility of the people who are doing the work in the medium. Where is it taking us? Are we losing our historical memory? That's the criticism anymore.
Well... you mean nationally, are we losing it? Yes, I think we are. I think it's terrible. I think the figure is that half the kids in high school don't take history anymore,
mm-hmm.
which is just appalling. And therefore, there's an enormous responsibility on people who do things like television, I think, to try to get it right. And we do work hard. It is always simpler than it really was because you have to telescope time and so
right.
on.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I was encouraged by the sheer number of people who sat through that whole Civil War, which... whatever else it was, is pretty dense
uh-huh.
history.
And nine innings of baseball.
And nine innings of baseball, which was very dense history. and the American Experience series, which I've also worked for,
mm-hmm.
Judy Crichton's thing on public television. I mean, I think many of those shows are you know, both historically accurate and very entertaining. And the numbers seem to bear that out. I think people love history if it's told as a story. I think one of the troubles is that the academic world, for quite a long time, historians lost interest in narrative and storytelling. They didn't really think the story was worth telling anymore,
mm-hmm.
and they instead did these sort of core samples that they analyze for one another's delectation.
Number crunching.
Number crunching, right. And some of it's very important and very useful, some of the stuff that comes out of it. But I hope it is beginning to be used to reassemble a new and better and more a richer
uh-huh.
story.
Fair enough.
That's my hope anyway.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Jeff Ward. What advice do you have for the next generation of professional biographers and historians? What have you learned as you've been through these wonderful books that you've put together on the life of FDR and large issues in our culture like the Civil War and baseball?
I think you can find enormous fascination in chronology and story. And I think that's what interests people. It's certainly what interests me, and I think it's what interests readers and viewers. And I think once you are telling a story, you can you can enormously enrich it.
Jeffrey Ward is the editor of Closest Companion, published last year by Houghton Mifflin. Jeffrey Ward's other books include two volumes about Franklin Roosevelt's early life, Before the Trumpet and A First-Class Temperament. He's also co-author of the public television series on the Civil War and baseball. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 814. That's $10, program number 814. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you'd like to have more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. Next week on Soundings, writer Moira Crone. She'll be here to read from and talk about her new book, a collection of stories entitled Dream State. With a preview of that show, here is Moira Crone.
Of course I know who Stanton Lyman is, one of those Mind of the South types. Sometimes he comes on TV to explain what Creoles are, what Louisiana really believed during the Civil War, who shot Long. Nobody ever seems to remember these things for sure. All the big questions are still left open, I've noticed, in Louisiana. Are women people? Did Elvis die? Was slavery wrong? People here are still ready to argue these points. Stanton was apologetic, proud, and burdened all at once, a minor native celebrity.
Writer Moira Crone, reading from her new collection of stories, Dream State. She'll be here next week with more from her new book. Until then, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.